This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Frostbite by Rochelle Mead. Read for you by Christine Bam.
Prologue. Things die, but they don't always stay dead. Believe me, I know. There's a race of vampires on this earth who are literally the walking dead. They're called Strigoi. And if you're not already having nightmares about them, you should be. They're strong, they're fast, and they kill without mercy or hesitation. They're immortal, too, which kind of makes them a bitch to destroy. There are only three ways to do it. A silver stake through the heart, decapitation, and setting them on fire. None of those is easy to pull off. But it's better than having no options at all. There are also good vampires walking the world. They're called Moroi. They're alive, and they possess the incredibly cool power to wield magic in each of the four elements. Earth, air, water, and fire. Well, most Moroi can do this, but I'll explain more about the exceptions later. They don't really use the magic for much anymore, which is kind of sad. It'd be a great weapon, but the Moroi strongly believe magic should only be used peacefully. It's one of the biggest rules in their society. Moroi are also usually tall and slim, and they can't handle a lot of sunlight, but they do have superhuman senses that make up for it: sight, smell, and hearing. Both kinds of vampires need blood. That's what makes them vampires, I guess. Moroi don't kill to take it, however. Instead, they keep humans around who willingly donate small amounts. They volunteer because vampire bites contain endorphins that feel really, really good and can become addictive. I know this from personal experience. These humans are called feeders and are essentially vampire bite junkies. Still, keeping feeders around is better than the way the Strigoi do things because, as you might expect, they kill for their blood. I think they like it. If a Moroi kills a victim while drinking, he or she will turn into a Strigoi. Some Moroi do this by choice, giving up their magic and their morals for immortality. Strigoi can also be created by force. If a Strigoi drinks blood from a victim and then makes that person drink Strigoi blood in return, well, you get a new Strigoi. This can happen to anyone, Moroi, human, or Dampir. Dampir, that's what I am. Dampirs are half-human, half-Moroi. I like to think we get the best traits of both races. I'm strong and sturdy like humans are. I can also go out into the sun as much as I want. But, like the Moroi, I have really good senses and fast reflexes. The result is that Dampirs make the ultimate bodyguards, which is what most of us are. We're called guardians. I've spent my entire life training to protect Moroi from Strigoi. I have a whole set of special classes and practices I take at St. Vladimir's Academy, a private school for Moroi and Dampirs. I know how to use all sorts of weapons and can land some pretty mean kicks. I've beaten up guys twice my size, both in and out of class. And really? Guys are pretty much the only ones I beat up, since there are very few girls in any of my classes. Because while Dampirs inherit all sorts of great traits, there's one thing we didn't get. Dampirs can't have children with other Dampirs. Don't ask me why, it's not like I'm a geneticist or anything. Humans and Moroi getting together will always make more Dampirs. That's where we come from in the first place. But that doesn't happen so much anymore. Moroi tend to stay away from humans. Through another weird genetic fluke, however, Moroi and Dampirs mixing will create Dampir children. I know, it's crazy. You'd think you'd get a baby that's three-quarters vampire, right? Nope. Half-human, half-Moroi. Most of these Dampirs are born from Moroi men and Dampir women getting together. Moroi women stick to having Moroi babies, What this usually means is that Moroi men have flings with Dampier women and then take off. This leaves a lot of single Dampier mothers, and that's why not as many of them become guardians. They'd rather focus on raising their children. As a result, only the guys and a handful of girls are left to become guardians. But those who choose to protect Moroi are serious about their jobs. Dampiers need Moroi to keep having kids. We have to protect them. Plus, it's just, well, it's the honorable thing to do. Strigoi are evil and unnatural. It isn't right for them to prey on the innocent. Dampiers who train to be guardians have this drilled into them from the time they can walk. Strigoi are evil. Moroi must be protected. Guardians believe this. I believe this. And there's one Moroi I want to protect more than anyone in the world. My best friend, Lyssa. She's a Moroi princess. The Moroi have 12 royal families, and she's the only one left in hers, the Dragomirs. But there's something else that makes Lyssa special, aside from her being my best friend. Remember when I said every Moroi wields one of the four elements? Well, it turns out Lyssa wields one no one even knew existed until recently. Spirit. For years, we thought she just wasn't going to develop her magical abilities. Then, strange things started happening around her. For example, all vampires have an ability called compulsion that lets them force their will on others. Strigoi have it really strongly. It's weaker in Moroi, and it's also forbidden. Lyssa, however, has it almost as much as a Strigoi. She can bat her eyelashes, and people will do what she wants. But that's not even the coolest thing she can do. I said earlier that dead things don't always stay dead. Well, I'm one of them. Don't worry, I'm not like the Strigoi, but I did die once. I don't recommend it. It happened when the car I was riding in slid off the road. The accident killed me, Lyssa's parents, and her brother. Yet somewhere in the chaos, without even realizing it, Lyssa used spirit to bring me back. We didn't know about this for a long time. In fact, we didn't even know spirit existed at all. Unfortunately, it turned out that one person did know about spirit before we did. Victor Doshkov. A dying Moroi prince found out about Lyssa's powers and decided he wanted to lock her up and make her his own personal healer for the rest of her life. When I realized someone was stalking her, I decided to take matters into my own hands. I broke us out of school to run off and live among humans. It was fun, but also kind of nerve-wracking to always be on the run. We got away with this for 2 years until the authorities at St. Vladimir's hunted us down and dragged us back a few months ago. That was when Victor made his real move, kidnapping her and torturing her until she gave in to his demands. In the process, he took some pretty extreme measures, like zapping me and Dimitri, my mentor, with a lust spell. I'll get to him later. Victor also exploited the way spirit was starting to make Lyssa mentally unstable. But even that wasn't as bad as what he did to his own daughter, Natalie. He went so far as to encourage her to turn into a Strigoi to help cover his escape. She ended up getting staked. Even when captured after the fact, Victor didn't seem to display too much guilt over what he'd asked her to do. Makes me think I wasn't missing out on growing up without a father. Still, I now have to protect Lyssa from Strigoi and Moroi. Only a few officials know about what she can do, but I'm sure there are other Victors out there who would want to use her. Fortunately, I have an extra weapon to help me guard her. Somewhere during my healing in the car accident, spirit forged a psychic bond between her and me. I can see and feel what she experiences. It only works one way, though. She can't feel me. The bond helps me keep an eye on her and know when she's in trouble, although sometimes it's weird having another person inside your head. We're pretty sure there are lots of other things spirit can do, but we don't know what they are yet. In the meantime, I'm trying to be the best guardian I can be. Running away put me behind in my training, so I have to take extra classes to make up for lost time. There's nothing in the world I want more than to keep Lyssa safe. Unfortunately, I've got two things that complicate my training now and then. One is that I sometimes act before I think. I'm getting better at avoiding this, but when something sets me off, I tend to punch first and then find out who I actually hit later. When it comes to those I care about being in danger, well, rules seem optional. The other problem in my life is Dimitri. He's the one who killed Natalie, and he's a total badass. He's also pretty good-looking. Okay, more than good-looking. He's hot, like the kind of hot that makes you stop walking on the street and get hit by traffic. But, like I said, he's my instructor. And he's 24. Both of those are reasons why I shouldn't have fallen for him. But honestly, the most important reason is that he and I will be Lyssa's guardians when she graduates. If he and I are checking each other out, then that means we aren't looking out for her. I haven't had much luck in getting over him, and I'm pretty sure he still feels the same about me. Part of what makes it so difficult is that he and I got pretty hot and heavy when we got hit with the lust spell. Victor had wanted to distract us while he kidnapped Lyssa, and it had worked. I'd been ready to give up my virginity, and Dimitri had been ready to take it. At the last minute, we broke the spell, but those memories are always with me, and make it kind of hard to focus on combat moves sometimes. By the way, my name's Rose Hathaway. I'm 17 years old, training to protect and kill vampires, in love with a completely unsuitable guy, and have a best friend whose weird magic could drive her crazy. Hey, no one said high school was easy. Chapter 1. I didn't think my day could get any worse until my best friend told me she might be going crazy. Again. What did you say? I stood in the lobby of her dorm, leaning over one of my boots and adjusting it. Jerking my head up, I peered at her through the tangle of dark hair covering half my face. I'd fallen asleep after school and had skipped using a hairbrush in order to make it out the door on time. Lyssa's platinum blonde hair was smooth and perfect, of course, hanging over her shoulders like a bridal veil as she watched me with amusement. I said, I think my pills might not be working as well anymore. I straightened up and shook the hair out of my face. What does that mean? I asked. Around us, Moroi hurried past, on their way to meet friends or go to dinner. Have you started... I lowered my voice. Have you started getting your powers back? She shook her head, and I saw a small flash of regret in her eyes. No, I feel closer to the magic, but I still can't use it. Mostly what I'm noticing lately is a little of the other stuff, you know? I'm getting more depressed now and then... Nothing even close to what it used to be, she added hastily, seeing my face. Before she'd gone on her pills, Lyssa's moods could get so low that she cut herself. It's just there a little more than it was. What about the other things you used to get? Anxiety? Delusional thinking? Lyssa laughed, not taking any of this as seriously as I was. You sound like you've been reading psychiatry textbooks. I actually had been reading them. I'm just worried about you. If you think the pills aren't working anymore, we need to tell someone. No, no, she said hastily. I'm fine, really. They're still working, just not quite as much. I don't think we should panic yet, especially you. Not today, at least. Her change in subject worked. I'd found out an hour ago that I would be taking my qualifier today. It was an exam, or rather, an interview. All novice guardians were required to pass during junior year at St. Vladimir's Academy. Since I'd been off hiding Lyssa last year, I'd missed mine. Today, I was being taken to a guardian somewhere off campus who would administer the test to me. Thanks for the notice, guys. Don't worry about me, Lyssa repeated, smiling. I'll let you know if it gets worse. Okay, I said reluctantly. Just to be safe, though, I opened my senses and allowed myself to truly feel her through our psychic bond. She had been telling the truth. She was calm and happy this morning. Nothing to worry about. But, far back in her mind, I sensed a knot of dark, uneasy feelings. It wasn't consuming her or anything, but it had the same feel as the bouts of depression and anger she used to get. It was only a trickle, but I didn't like it. I didn't want it there at all. I tried pushing farther inside her to get a better feel for the emotions, and suddenly had the weird experience of touching. A sickening sort of feeling seized me, and I jerked out of her head. A small shudder ran through my body. "You okay?" Lissa asked, frowning. "You look nauseous all of a sudden." "Just nervous for the test," I lied. Hesitantly, I reached out through the bond again. The darkness had completely disappeared. No trace. Maybe there was nothing wrong with her pills after all. "I'm fine." She pointed at a clock. "You won't be if you don't get moving soon." "Damn it," I swore. She was right. I gave her a quick hug. "See you later." "Good luck," she called. I hurried off across campus and found my mentor, Dmitry Belikov, waiting beside a Honda Pilot. How boring. I supposed I couldn't have expected us to navigate Montana mountain roads in a Porsche, but it would have been nice to have something cooler. I know, I said, seeing his face. "Sorry I'm late." I remembered then that I had one of the most important tests of my life coming up, and suddenly I forgot all about Lissa and her pills possibly not working. I wanted to protect her, but that wouldn't mean much if I couldn't pass high school and actually become her guardian. Dmitry stood there, looking as gorgeous as ever. The massive brick building cast long shadows over us, looming like some great beast in the dusky pre-dawn light. Around us, snow was just beginning to fall. I watched the light crystalline flakes drift gently down. Several landed and promptly melted in his dark hair. "Who else is going?" I asked. He shrugged. "Just you and me." My mood promptly shot up past cheerful and went straight to ecstatic. Me and Dmitry, alone, in a car? This might very well be worth a surprise test. "How far away is it?" Silently, I begged for it to be a really long drive, like one that would take a week and would involve us staying overnight in luxury hotels. Maybe we'd get stranded in a snowbank and only body heat would keep us alive.
5 hours.
Oh. A bit less than I'd hoped for. Still, 5 hours was better than nothing. It didn't rule out the snowbank possibility either. The dim, snowy roads would have been difficult for humans to navigate, but they proved no problem for our Dampier eyes. I stared ahead, trying not to think about how Dimitri's aftershave filled the car with a clean, sharp scent that made me want to melt. Instead, I tried to focus on the qualifier again. It wasn't the kind of thing you could study for. You either passed it, or you didn't. High-up guardians visited novices during their junior year and met individually to discuss students' commitment to being guardians. I didn't know exactly what was asked, but rumors had trickled down over the years. The older guardians assessed character and dedication, and some novices had been deemed unfit to continue down the guardian path. "Don't they usually come to the academy?" I asked Dmitry. "I mean, I'm all up for the field trip, but why are we going to them?"
"Actually, you're just going to a him, not a them."
A light Russian accent laced Dmitry's words, the only indication of where he'd grown up. Otherwise, I was pretty sure he spoke English better than I did.
"Since this is a special case and he's doing us a favor, we're the ones making the trip."
"Who is he?"
"Arthur Schoenberg."
I jerked my gaze from the road to Dmitry. "What?" I squeaked. Arthur Schoenberg was a legend. He was one of the greatest Strogoi slayers in living Guardian history and used to be the head of the Guardians' Council, the group of people who assigned guardians to Moroi and made decisions for all of us. He'd eventually retired and gone back to protecting one of the royal families, the Badikas. Even retired, I knew he was still lethal. His exploits were part of my curriculum.
Wasn't there anyone else available?
I asked in a small voice. I could see Dmitry hiding a smile.
"You'll be fine. Besides, if Art approves of you, that's a great recommendation to have on your record."
Art?
Dimitri was on a first-name basis with one of the most badass guardians around. Of course, Dimitri was pretty badass himself, so I shouldn't have been surprised. Silence fell in the car. I bit my lip, suddenly wondering if I'd be able to meet Arthur Schoenberg's standards. My grades were good, but things like running away and getting into fights at school might cast a shadow on how serious I was about my future career.
"You'll be fine," Dimitri repeated. "The good in your record outweighs the bad."
It was like he could read my mind sometimes. I smiled a little and dared to peek at him. It was a mistake. A long, lean body, obvious even while sitting. Bottomless dark eyes, shoulder-length brown hair tied back at his neck. That hair felt like silk. I knew because I'd run my fingers through it when Viktor Dashkov had ensnared us with a lust charm. With great restraint, I forced myself to start breathing again and look away. "Thanks, Coach," I teased, snuggling back into the seat.
"I'm here to help," he replied.
His voice was light and relaxed, rare for him. He was usually wound up tightly, ready for any attack. Probably he figured he was safe inside a Honda, or at least as safe as he could be around me. I wasn't the only one who had trouble ignoring the romantic tension between us.
"You know what would really help?" I asked, not meeting his eyes. "If you turned off this crap music and put something that came out after the Berlin Wall went down."
Dimitri laughed.
"Your worst class is history, yet somehow you know everything about Eastern Europe."
"Hey, gotta have material for my jokes, comrade."
Still smiling, he turned the radio dial.
"To a country station."
"Hey, this isn't what I had in mind," I exclaimed.
I could tell he was on the verge of laughing again.
"Pick. It's one or the other."
I sighed. "Go back to the 1980s stuff."
He flipped the dial and I crossed my arms over my chest, and some vaguely European-sounding band sang about how video had killed the radio star. I wished someone would kill this radio. Suddenly, 5 hours didn't seem as short as I'd thought.
Arthur and the family he protected lived in a small town along I-90, not far from Billings. The general Moroi opinion was split on places to live. Some argued that big cities were the best since they allowed vampires to be lost in the crowds. Nocturnal activities didn't raise so much attention. Other Moroi, like this family, apparently opted for less populated towns, believing that if there were fewer people to notice you, then you were less likely to be noticed. I'd convinced Dimitri to stop for food at a 24-hour diner along the way, and between that and stopping to buy gas, it was around noon when we arrived. The house was built in a rambler style, all one level with gray-stained wood siding and big bay windows, tinted to block sunlight, of course. It looked new and expensive, and even out in the middle of nowhere, it was about what I'd expected for members of a royal family. I jumped down from the Pilot, my boots sinking through an inch of smooth snow and crunching on the gravel of the driveway. The day was still and silent, save for the occasional breath of wind. Dimitri and I walked up to the house, following a river rock sidewalk that cut through the front yard. I could see him sliding into his business mode, but his overall attitude was as cheery as mine. We'd both taken a kind of guilty satisfaction in the pleasant car ride. My foot slipped on the ice-covered sidewalk, and Dimitri instantly reached out to steady me. I had a weird moment of déjà vu, flashing back to the first night we'd met, back when he'd also saved me from a similar fall. Freezing temperatures or not, his hand felt warm on my arm, even through the layers of down in my parka coat.
"You okay?"
He released his hold to my dismay.
"Yeah," I said, casting accusing eyes at the icy sidewalk. "Haven't these people ever heard of salt?"
I meant it jokingly, but Dimitri suddenly stopped walking. I instantly came to a halt, too. His expression became tense and alert. He turned his head, eyes searching the broad white plains surrounding us before settling back on the house. I wanted to ask questions, but something in his posture told me to stay silent.
He studied the building for almost a full minute, looked down at the icy sidewalk, then glanced back at the driveway, covered in a sheet of snow broken only by our footprints. Cautiously, he approached the front door, and I followed. He stopped again, this time to study the door. It wasn't open, but it wasn't entirely shut either. It looked like it had been closed in haste, not sealing. Further examination showed scuffs along the door's edge, as though it had been forced at some point. The slightest nudge would open it. Dimitri lightly ran his fingers along where the door met its frame, his breath making small clouds in the air. When he touched the door's handle, it jiggled a little, like it had been broken. Finally, he said quietly, "Rose, go wait in the car."
"But what..."
"Go." One word, but one filled with power. In that single syllable, I was reminded of the man I'd seen throw people around and stake a Strigoi. I backed up, walking on the snow-covered lawn rather than risk the sidewalk. Dimitri stood where he was, not moving until I'd slipped back into the car, closing the door as softly as possible. Then, with the gentlest of movements, he pushed on the barely held door and disappeared inside. Burning with curiosity, I counted to 10 and then climbed out of the car. I knew better than to go in after him, but I had to know what was going on with this house. The neglected sidewalk and driveway indicated that no one had been home for a couple days, although it could also mean that the Badikas simply never left the house. It was possible, I supposed, that they'd been the victims of an ordinary break-in by humans. It was also possible that something had scared them off, say like Strigoi. I knew that possibility was what made Dimitri's face turn so grim, but it seemed an unlikely scenario with Arthur Schoenberg on duty. Standing on the driveway, I glanced up at the sky. The light was bleak and watery, but it was there. Noon, the sun's highest point today. Strigoi couldn't be out in sunlight. I didn't need to fear them, only Dimitri's anger. I circled around the right side of the house, walking in much deeper snow, almost a foot of it. Nothing else weird about the house struck me. Icicles hung from the eaves, and the tinted windows revealed no secrets. My foot suddenly hit something, and I looked down. There, half buried in the snow, was a silver stake. It had been driven into the ground. I picked it up and brushed off the snow, frowning. What was a stake doing out here? Silver stakes were valuable. They were a guardian's most deadly weapon, capable of killing a Strigoi with a single strike through the heart. When they were forged, four Moroi charmed them with magic from each of the four elements. I hadn't learned to use one yet, but gripping it in my hand, I suddenly felt safer as I continued my survey. A large patio door led from the back of the house to a wooden deck that probably would have been a lot of fun to hang out on in the summer. But the patio's glass had been broken, so much so that a person could easily get through the jagged hole. I crept up the deck steps, careful of the ice, knowing I was going to get in major trouble when Dimitri found out what I was doing. In spite of the cold, sweat poured down my neck. Daylight. Daylight, I reminded myself. Nothing to worry about. I reached the patio and studied the dark glass. I couldn't tell what had broken it. Just inside, snow had blown in and made a small drift on pale blue carpet. I tugged on the door's handle, but it was locked. Not that that mattered with a hole that big. Careful of the sharp edges, I reached through the opening and unlocked the handle's latch from the inside. I removed my hand just as carefully and pulled open the sliding door. It hissed slightly along its tracks, a quiet sound that nonetheless seemed too loud in the eerie silence. I stepped through the doorway, standing in the patch of sunlight that had been cast inside by opening the door. My eyes adjusted from the sun to the dimness within. Wind swirled through the open patio, dancing with the curtains around me. I was in a living room. It had all the ordinary items one might expect. Couches, TV,
a rocking chair, and a body. It was a woman. She lay on her back in front of the TV, her dark hair spilling on the floor around her. Her wide eyes stared upward, blankly, her face pale. Too pale even for a Maroi. For a moment, I thought her long hair was covering her neck, too, until I realized that the darkness across her skin was blood. Dried blood. Her throat had been ripped out. The horrible scene was so surreal that I didn't even realize what I was seeing at first. With her posture, the woman might very well have been sleeping. Then I took in the other body. A man on his side, only a couple feet away, dark blood staining the carpet around him. Another body was slumped beside the couch, small, child size. Across the room was another, and another. There were bodies everywhere. Bodies and blood. The scale of death around me suddenly registered, and my heart began pounding. No. No. It wasn't possible. It was day. Bad things couldn't happen in daylight. A scream started to rise in my throat, suddenly halted, when a gloved hand came from behind me and closed over my mouth. I started to struggle. Then I smelled Dimitri's aftershave.
Why? He asked. Don't you ever listen? You'd be dead if they were still here.
I couldn't answer, both because of the hand and my own shock. I'd seen someone die once, but I'd never seen death of this magnitude. After almost a minute, Dimitri finally removed his hand, but he stayed close behind me. I didn't want to look anymore, but I seemed unable to drag my eyes away from the scene before me. Bodies everywhere. Bodies and blood. Finally, I turned toward him. It's daytime, I whispered. Bad things don't happen in the day. I heard the desperation in my voice, a little girl's plea that someone would say this was all a bad dream.
Bad things can happen anytime, he told me. And this didn't happen during the day. This probably happened a couple of nights ago.
I dared a peek back at the bodies and felt my stomach twist. 2 days? 2 days to be dead, to have your existence snuffed out, without anyone in the world even knowing you were gone. My eyes fell on a man's body near the room's entrance to a hallway. He was tall, too well built to be a Maroi. Dimitri must have noticed where I looked.
Arthur Schoenberg, he said.
I stared at Arthur's bloody throat. He's dead, I said, as though it wasn't perfectly obvious. How can he be dead? How could a Strigoi kill Arthur Schoenberg? It didn't seem possible. You couldn't kill a legend. Dimitri didn't answer. Instead, his hand moved down and closed around where my own hand held the stake. I flinched.
Where did you get this? He asked.
I loosened my grip and let him take the stake. Outside, in the ground. He held up the stake, studying its surface as it shone in the sunlight.
It broke the ward.
My mind, still stunned, took a moment to process what he'd said. Then I got it. Wards were magic rings cast by Maroi. Like the stakes, they were made using magic from all four elements. They required strong Maroi magic users, often a couple for each element. The wards could block Strigoi because magic was charged with life, and the Strigoi had none. But wards faded quickly and took a lot of maintenance. Most Maroi didn't use them, but certain places kept them up. St. Vladimir's Academy was ringed with several. There had been a ward here, but it had been shattered when someone drove the stake through it. Their magic conflicted with each other. The stake had won. Strigoi can't touch stakes, I told him. I realized I was using a lot of can't and don't statements. It wasn't easy having your core beliefs challenged. And no Maroi or Dampier would do it.
A human might.
I met his eyes.
Humans don't help Strigoi. I stopped. There it was again. Don't. But I couldn't help it. The one thing we could count on in the fight against Strigoi was their limitations. Sunlight, ward, stake magic, etc. We used their weaknesses against them. If they had others, humans, who would help them and weren't affected by those limitations? Dimitri's face was stern, still ready for anything, but the tiniest spark of sympathy flashed in his dark eyes as he watched me wage my mental battle. This changes everything, doesn't it? I asked.
Yeah,
he said.
It does.
Chapter 2. Dimitri made one phone call, and a veritable SWAT team showed up. It took a couple of hours, though, and every minute spent waiting felt like a year. I finally couldn't take it anymore and returned to the car. Dimitri examined the house further, then came to sit with me. Neither of us said a word while we waited. A slideshow of the grisly sights inside the house kept playing in my mind. I felt scared and alone and wished he would hold me or comfort me in some way. Immediately, I scolded myself for wanting that. I reminded myself for the 1,000th time that he was my instructor and had no business holding me, no matter what the situation was. Besides, I wanted to be strong. I didn't need to go running to some guy every time things got tough. When the first group of guardians showed up, Dimitri opened the car door and glanced over at me.
You should see how this is done.
I didn't want to see any more of that house, honestly, but I followed anyway. These guardians were strangers to me, but Dimitri knew them. He always seemed to know everybody. This group was surprised to find a novice on the scene, but none of them protested my presence. I walked behind them as they examined the house. None of them touched anything, but they knelt by the bodies and studied the bloodstains and broken windows. Apparently, the Strigoi had entered the house through more than just the front door and back patio. The guardian spoke in brusque tones, displaying none of the disgust and fear I felt. They were like machines. One of them, the only woman in the group, crouched beside Arthur Schoenberg. I was intrigued, since female guardians were so rare. I'd heard Dimitri call her Tamara, and she looked about 25. Her black hair just barely touched her shoulders, which was common for guardian women. Sadness flickered in her gray eyes as she studied the dead guardian's face.
Oh, Arthur,
she sighed. Like Dimitri, she managed to convey 100 things in just a couple words. Never thought I'd see this day. He was my mentor. With another sigh, Tamara rose. Her face had become all businesslike once more, as though the guy who'd trained her wasn't lying there in front of her. I couldn't believe it. He was her mentor. How could she keep that kind of control? For half a heartbeat, I imagined seeing Dimitri dead on the floor instead. No, no way could I have stayed calm in her place. I would have gone on a rampage. I would have screamed and kicked things. I would have hit anyone who tried to tell me things would be okay. Fortunately, I didn't believe anyone could actually take down Dimitri. I'd seen him kill a Strigoi without breaking a sweat. He was invincible. A badass. A god. Of course, Arthur Schoenberg had been too. How could they do that? I blurted out. 6 sets of eyes turned to me. I expected a chastising look from Dimitri for my outburst, but he merely appeared curious. How could they kill him? Tamara gave a small shrug, her face still composed. The same way they kill everyone else. He's mortal, just like the rest of us. Yeah, but he's, you know, Arthur Schoenberg.
You tell us, Rose,
said Dimitri.
You've seen the house. Tell us how they did it.
As they watched me, I suddenly realized I might be undergoing a test after all today. I thought about what I'd observed and heard. I swallowed, trying to figure out how the impossible could be possible.
There were 4 points of entry, which means at least 4 Strigoi. There were 7 Moroi. The family who lived here had been entertaining some other people, making the massacre that much larger. 3 of the victims had been children. And 3 guardians. Too many kills. 4 Strigoi couldn't have taken down that many. 6 probably could if they went for the guardians first and caught them by surprise. The family would have been too panicked to fight back.
And how did they catch the guardians by surprise?
Dimitri prompted. I hesitated. Guardians, as a general rule, didn't get caught by surprise. Because the wards were broken. In a household without wards, there'd probably be a guardian walking the yard at night. But they wouldn't have done that here. I waited for the next obvious question about how the wards had been broken, but Dimitri didn't ask it. There was no need. We all knew. We'd all seen the stake. Again, a chill ran down my spine. Humans working with Strigoi. A large group of Strigoi. Dimitri simply nodded as a sign of approval, and the group continued their survey. When we reached the bathroom, I started to avert my gaze. I'd already seen this room with Dimitri earlier and had no wish to repeat the experience. There was a dead man in there, and his dried blood stood out in stark contrast against the white tile. Also, since this room was more interior, it wasn't as cold as the area by the open patio. No preservation. The body didn't smell bad yet, exactly, but it didn't smell right either. But as I started to turn away, I caught a glimpse of something dark red, more brown, really, in the mirror. I hadn't noticed it before because the rest of the scene had held all of my attention. There was writing on the mirror, done in blood. Poor, poor Badikas. So few left. One royal family nearly gone. Others to follow. Tamara snorted in disgust and turned away from the mirror, studying other details of the bathroom. As we walked out, though, those words repeated in my head. One royal family nearly gone. Others to follow. The Badikas were one of the smaller royal clans, it was true, but it was hardly like those who had been killed here were the last of them. There were probably almost 200 Badikas left. That wasn't as many as a family like, say, the Avashkovs. That particular royal family was huge and widespread. There were, however, a lot more Badikas than there were some other royals, like the Dragomirs. Lyssa was the only one left. If the Strigoi wanted to snuff out royal lines, there was no better chance than to go after her. Moroi blood empowered Strigoi, so I understood their desire for that. I suppose specifically targeting royals was simply part of their cruel and sadistic nature. It was ironic that Strigoi would want to tear apart Moroi society, since many of them had once been a part of it. The mirror and its warning consumed me for the rest of our stay at the house, and I found my fear and shock transforming into anger. How could they do this? How could any creature be so twisted and evil that they'd do this to a family? That they'd want to wipe out an entire bloodline? How could any creature do this when they'd once been like me and Lyssa? And thinking of Lyssa, thinking of Strigoi wanting to wipe out her family too, stirred up a dark rage within me. The intensity of that emotion nearly knocked me over. It was something black and miasmic, swelling and roiling. A storm cloud ready to burst. I suddenly wanted to tear up every Strigoi I could get my hands on. When I finally got into the car to ride back to St. Vladimir's with Dimitri, I slammed the door so hard that it was a wonder it didn't fall off. He glanced at me in surprise.
What's wrong?
Are you serious? I exclaimed, incredulous. How can you ask that? You were there. You saw that.
I did, he agreed. But I'm not taking it out on the car.
I fastened my seatbelt and glowered. I hate them. I hate them all. I wished I'd been there. I would have ripped their throats out. I was nearly shouting. Dimitri stared at me, face calm, but he was clearly astonished at my outburst.
You really think that's true?
He asked me.
You think you could have done better than Art Schoenberg after seeing what the Strigoi did in there, after seeing what Natalie did to you.
I faltered. I'd tangled briefly with Lys's cousin Natalie when she became a Strigoi, just before Dimitri had shown up to save the day. Even as a new Strigoi, weak and uncoordinated, she'd literally thrown me around the room. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. Suddenly, I felt stupid. I'd seen what Strigoi could do. Me running in impetuously and trying to save the day would have only resulted in a quick death. I was developing into a tough guardian, but I still had a lot to learn. And one 17-year-old girl couldn't have stood against 6 Strigoi. I opened my eyes. "I'm sorry," I said, gaining control of myself. The rage that had exploded inside me diffused. I didn't know where it had come from. I had a short temper and often acted impulsively, but this had been intense and ugly even for me. Weird.
"It's okay,"
said Dimitri. He reached over and placed his hand on mine for a few moments. Then he removed it and started the car.
"It's been a long day. For all of us."
When we got back to St. Vladimir's Academy around midnight, everyone knew about the massacre. The vampiric school day had just ended, and I hadn't slept in more than 24 hours. I was bleary-eyed and sluggish, and Dimitri ordered me to immediately go back to my dorm room and get some sleep. He, of course, looked alert and ready to take on anything. Sometimes I really wasn't sure if he slept at all. He headed off to consult with other guardians about the attack, and I promised him I'd go straight to bed. Instead, I turned toward the library once he was out of sight. I needed to see Lyssa, and the bond told me that was where she was. It was pitch black as I walked along the stone walkway that crossed the quad from my dorm to the secondary school's main building. Snow completely covered the grass, but the sidewalk had been meticulously cleared of all ice and snow. It reminded me of the poor Badika's neglected home. The commons building was large and Gothic-looking, more suited to a medieval movie set than a school. Inside, that air of mystery and ancient history continued to permeate the building. Elaborate stone walls and antique paintings warring with computers and fluorescent lights. Modern technology had a foothold here, but it would never dominate. Slipping through the library's electronic gate, I immediately headed for one of the back corners where geography and travel books were kept. Sure enough, I found Lyssa sitting there on the floor, leaning against a bookcase. "Hey," she said, looking up from an open book propped up on one knee. She brushed a few strands of pale hair out of her face. Her boyfriend, Christian, lay on the floor near her, his head propped up on her other knee. He greeted me by way of a nod. Considering the antagonism that sometimes flared up between us, that was almost on par with him giving me a bear hug. Despite her small smile, I could feel the tension and fear in her. It sang through the bond. "You heard," I said, sitting down cross-legged. Her smile slipped and the feelings of fear and unease within her intensified. I liked that our psychic connection let me protect her better, but I didn't really need my own troubled feelings amplified. "It's awful," she said with a shudder. Christian shifted and linked his fingers through hers. He squeezed her hand. She squeezed back. Those two were so in love and sugary sweet with each other that I felt like brushing my teeth after being around them. They were subdued just now, however, no doubt thanks to the massacre news.
They're saying there were 6 or 7 Strigoi, and that humans helped them break the wards.
I leaned my head back against a shelf. News really did travel fast. Suddenly, I felt dizzy. "It's true."
"Really?"
asked Christian.
"I figured that was just a bunch of hyped-up paranoia." "No."
I realized then that nobody knew where I'd been today.
I was there.
Lyssa's eyes widened, shock coursing into me from her. Even Christian, the poster child for smartass, looked grim. If not for the horribleness of it all, I would have taken satisfaction in catching him off guard.
"You're joking," he said,
voice uncertain.
I thought you were taking your qualifier.
Lissa's words trailed off.
I was supposed to, I said. It was just a wrong place and wrong time kind of thing. The guardian who was going to give me the test lived there. Dimitri and I walked in and... I couldn't finish. Images of the blood and death that had filled the Badika house flashed through my mind again. Concern crossed Lissa's face and the bond. Rose, are you okay? She asked softly. Lissa was my best friend, but I didn't want her to know how scared and upset the whole thing had made me. I wanted to be fierce.
Fine, I said, teeth clenched. What was it like? Asked Christian.
Curiosity filled his voice, but there was guilt there, too.
Like he knew it was wrong to want to know about such a horrible thing. He couldn't stop himself from asking, though. Lack of impulse control was one thing we had in common.
It was... I shook my head. I don't want to talk about it.
Christian started to protest, and then Lissa ran a hand through his sleek black hair. The gentle admonishment silenced him. A moment of awkwardness hung between us all. Reading Lissa's mind, I felt her desperately grope for a new topic.
They say this is going to mess up all the holiday visits, she told me after several more moments.
Christian's aunt is going to visit, but most people don't want to travel, and they want their kids to stay here, where it's safe.
They're terrified this group of Strigoi is on the move.
I hadn't thought about the ramifications of an attack like this. We were only a week or so away from Christmas. Usually, there was a huge wave of travel in the Moroi world this time of year. Students went home to visit their parents. Parents came to stay on campus and visit their children. This is going to keep a lot of families separated, I murmured.
And mess up a lot of royal get-togethers, said Christian.
His brief seriousness had vanished. His snide air was back.
You know how they are this time of year, always competing with each other to throw the biggest parties. They won't know what to do with themselves.
I couldn't believe it. My life was about fighting, but the Moroi certainly had their share of internal strife, particularly with nobles and royals. They waged their own battles with words and political alliances, and honestly, I prefer the more direct method of hitting and kicking. Lissa and Christian in particular had to navigate some troubled waters. They were both from royal families, which meant they got a lot of attention both inside and outside of the academy. Things were worse for them than for most Moroi royals. Christian's family lived under the shadow cast by his parents. They had purposefully become Strigoi, trading their magic and morality to become immortal and subsist on killing others. His parents were dead now, but that didn't stop people from not trusting him. They seemed to think he'd go Strigoi at any moment and take everyone else with him. His abrasiveness and dark sense of humor didn't really help things either. Lissa's attention came from being the last one left in her family. No other Moroi had enough Dragomir blood in them to earn the name. Her future husband would probably have enough somewhere in his family tree to make sure her children were Dragomirs. But for now, being the only one made her kind of a celebrity. Thinking about this suddenly reminded me of the warning scrawled on the mirror. Nausea welled up in me. That dark anger and despair stirred, but I pushed it aside with a joke. You guys should try solving your problems like we do. A fistfight here and there might do you royals some good. Both Lissa and Christian laughed at this. He glanced up at her with a sly smile, showing his fangs as he did.
What do you think? I bet I could take you if we went one-on-one.
You wish, she teased. Her troubled feelings lightened.
I do, actually,
he said, holding her gaze. There was an intensely sensual note to his voice that made her heart race. Jealousy shot through me. She and I had been best friends our entire life. I could read her mind. But the fact remained, Christian was a huge part of her world now, and he played a role I never could. Just as he could never have a part of the connection that existed between me and her. We both sort of accepted but didn't like the fact that we had to split her attention. And at times, it seems the truce we held for her sake was paper thin. Lissa brushed her hand against his cheek.
Behave.
I am,
he told her, his voice still a little husky.
Sometimes. But sometimes you don't want me to.
Groaning, I stood up. God, I'm going to leave you guys alone now.
Lissa blinked and dragged her eyes away from Christian, suddenly looking embarrassed.
Sorry, she murmured. A delicate pink flush spread over her cheeks. Since she was pale like all Maroi, it actually sort of made her look prettier. Not that she needed much help in that department.
You don't have to go.
No, it's fine. I'm exhausted, I assured her. Christian didn't look too broken up about seeing me leave. I'll catch you tomorrow.
I started to turn away, but Lissa called to me. Rose, are you sure you're okay? After everything that happened?
I met her jade green eyes. Her concern was so strong and deep that it made my chest ache. I might be closer to her than anyone else in the world, but I didn't want her worrying about me. It was my job to keep her safe. She shouldn't be troubled about protecting me, particularly if Strigoi had suddenly decided to make a hit list of royals. I flashed her a saucy grin. I'm fine. Nothing to worry about except you guys tearing each other's clothes off before I get a chance to leave.
Then you'd better go now, said Christian dryly.
She elbowed him, and I rolled my eyes.
Good night,
I told them. As soon as my back was to them, my smile vanished. I walked back to my dorm with a heavy heart, hoping I wouldn't dream about the Badikas tonight. Chapter 3 The lobby of my dorm was abuzz when I sprinted downstairs to my before-school practice. The commotion didn't surprise me. A good night's sleep had gone far to chase away the images from last night, but I knew neither I nor my classmates would easily forget what had taken place outside Billings. And yet, as I studied the faces and clusters of other novices, I noticed something weird. The fear and tension from yesterday were still around, certainly. But something new was there, too. Excitement. A couple of freshman novices were practically squealing with joy as they spoke in hushed whispers. Nearby, a group of guys my own age were gesturing wildly, enthusiastic grins on their faces. I had to be missing something here, unless all of yesterday had been a dream. It took every ounce of self-control I had not to go over and ask somebody what was happening. If I delayed, I'd be late for practice. The curiosity was killing me, though. Had the Strigoi and their humans been found and killed? That would certainly be good news, but something told me that wasn't the case. Pushing open the front doors, I lamented that I'd just have to wait until breakfast to find out.
Hathaway, don't run away, a sing-song voice called.
I glanced behind me and grinned. Mason Ashford, another novice and a good friend of mine, jogged up and fell in step with me.
What are you, 12? I asked, continuing on toward the gym.
Nearly, he said. I missed your smiling face yesterday. Where were you?
Apparently, my presence at the Badika house still wasn't widely known. It wasn't a secret or anything, but I didn't want to discuss any gory details.
Had a training thing with Dimitri.
God, muttered Mason.
That guy is always working you. Doesn't he realize he's depriving us of your beauty and charm?
Smiling face, beauty and charm? You're laying it on a little thick this morning, aren't you? I laughed.
Hey, I'm just telling it like it is. Really, you're lucky to have someone as suave and brilliant as me paying this much attention to you.
I kept grinning. Mason was a huge flirt, and he liked to flirt with me in particular. Part of it was just because I was good at it, and I liked to flirt back. But I knew his feelings toward me were more than just friendly, and I was still deciding how I felt about that. He and I had the same goofy sense of humor and frequently drew attention to ourselves in class and among friends. He had gorgeous blue eyes and messy red hair that never seemed to lie flat. It was cute. But dating someone new was going to be kind of difficult when I still kept thinking about the time I was half-naked in bed with Dimitri.
Suave and brilliant, huh? I shook my head. I don't think you pay nearly as much attention to me as you do your ego. Someone needs to knock it down a little.
Oh, yeah?
he asked.
Well, you can try your best on the slopes.
I stopped walking.
The what?
The slopes, he tilted his head.
You know, the ski trip.